This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top, Big Dollars Needed to Execute Centennial's Vision. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. When the planners for North Carolina State University's Centennial Campus were mapping out the 1,000-acre campus, they left space among the buildings to one day build a monorail system. That was almost 30 years ago. With very little progress on that front, foot traffic continues to be the primary means of transportation around the research campus today. But all that may soon change. A group of university leaders are working on an action plan to use more of the research for advanced transportation and smart grid technology coming out of Centennial Campus laboratories and classrooms. They're calling it Vision 2034, signifying the year that Centennial Campus will celebrate its 50-year anniversary. And it's exactly what it sounds like, a vision for how the campus will look, feel, and interact by the year 2034. We are hoping the campus can be a test bed, a sort of living laboratory, says Terry Lomax, Vice Chancellor of Research, Innovation, and Economic Development at NC State, who has been leading the Vision 2034 project over the past year and a half. We're doing some of this already, and we want to expand that as much as possible. Lomax says university officials have not yet put a price tag on implementation of each of the goals in the Vision 2034 plan. The most expensive of the Vision 2034 goals, the advanced transportation system, could cost as much as $40 million a mile if the university were to build its own light rail or monorail system. But a gondola system like the one at the London Airport and one proposed in Midtown Raleigh could cost about $4 million per mile. That can make a huge difference in making it a reality, she says. Centennial Campus was started with about 700 acres, once part of the Dorothea Dix Hospital, that was deeded to NC State University as part of a land grant in 1984. The campus now includes multiple classroom and research facilities, including the College of Textiles and the College of Engineering, and two dozen more buildings that were both publicly and privately funded for university research programs, as well as those by its corporate partners conducting research in collaboration with the university. The university also opened a university housing complex on campus in 2013, and a private developer will open the first non-student apartment complex on Centennial Campus in early 2014. A newly updated master plan for Centennial Campus is expected to be presented to university trustees in April, says Michael Harwood, Associate Vice Chancellor for the Centennial Campus Development Office. One of the biggest changes proposed in the new master plan is a better connection from the university's main campus to Centennial Campus and to the smaller Centennial Biomedical Campus on Blue Ridge Road. Right now, it's tough getting from the bell tower to the vet school, Harwood says, so we're looking at our options for people mover systems. That could mean monorail or personal transport pods, like at London's Heathrow Airport, more buses, or something else they haven't considered yet. Harwood says work has already started on an updated ridership study for the campuses. Also in the first quarter, planning will begin for a new 15-acre mixed-use project at Centennial Campus called Town Center. The project could potentially build up to 500,000 square feet of buildings with a mix of retail, office, and residential, Harwood says. A request for proposals is expected to be issued in January or February, but could be delayed to March. Dennis Kakus, Associate Vice Chancellor for the Centennial Campus Partnership Office, notes that the Town Center project could become an important piece of the Living Laboratory goal under the Vision 2034 plan. Centennial Campus is already like a small town, and if you want to test new concepts, you've got a place where you can control things to a certain extent, Kakus says. He points to the Centennial Mesh Network that was launched in 2012, a large-scale experimental Wi-Fi network on campus that's being used to test network security, encryption, and other applications, and the turf grass research being done at the university's golf course property, Lonnie Pool, as examples. We talked to a company recently that's working on an autonomous vehicle like the Google car, and we have the pathways on campus already where it could be tested, he says. And the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is a large picture of a man looking through binoculars. It's a picture highlighting the 2014 People to Watch articles that are inside the Triangle Business Journal, and we'll read those when we get to the reporter pages. But for now, we'll turn to the biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Paragon primed for private banking. With little fanfare, Raleigh's Paragon Commercial Bank changed its name to Paragon Bank in the past week, so Biz was curious about the bank's plans going forward. Bob Hatley, longtime CEO of the bank, says that while the bank will continue to emphasize commercial loans as part of its primary business, it also wants to brand itself as a private bank for individuals. To get that going, the 63-year-old Hatley tells Biz that Paragon will open an office near Prestonwood and Cary in the next few months. It will be our prototype for our private banking clients, he says. No ATMs, no drive-through. You come in and we talk, he says. The bank, with offices in Raleigh and Charlotte, also changed its website to paragonbank.com. So Biz was wondering, is Paragon getting into the wealth management business to compete with the big boys at Wells Fargo, PNC Financial Services, and First Citizens Bank? Hatley says initially Paragon will have wealth management partners who will help the bank's clients. In the long term, Hatley admits the answer is maybe. Lenovo Santas bring tablets of great joy. Lenovo employees put on their elf caps last week, arranging a holiday surprise at Apex High School. That surprise involved 35 yoga tablets for the hardworking teachers, says spokesperson Milanka Miuki. Lenovo already has a relationship with Apex High School through the National Academy Foundation program. Additionally, Apex is an Academy of Information Technology school, which aligns with Lenovo's STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math initiatives. Teachers were given book bags with the Lenovo tablet and case to use during group studies. From smokes to startups, he's been there. Durham Mayor Bill Bell, who easily won a seventh term in November's election, recently reminisced with Biz about all the changes Durham has seen in the past few decades. Although he grew up in Winston-Salem, Bell settled in Durham while working as an engineer at IBM. He's been involved in local government since the 1970s. Bell laughs at Biz's mention of field trips to North Carolina tobacco factories that were deemed an essential part of our elementary school education. Oh yes, I remember those, he says, recalling the tours that ended with a free mini pack of cigarettes. Over the course of his public service, Bell has seen Durham transformed from the city of tobacco to the city of medicine and technology, and he clearly hasn't lost any energy for helping the Bull City be prepared for the next phase of its growth. Yao's farewell to Terps belongs to the ages. The Sports Business Journal, a sister publication to TBJ, recently celebrated its 20th anniversary and highlighted some of the best quotes from the past two decades. Not surprisingly, NC State Athletic Director Debbie Yao made the list for a memorable quote she delivered when speaking about the University of Maryland, where she formerly worked, and its decision to leave the ACC for the Big Ten. "They're going to be missed, there's no question about that, but they're going to be on a plane going to Madison, Wisconsin to play men's basketball in the middle of winter. Good luck. I hope the money is really good." How to entice Mark Cuban's checkbook. Want an equity investment from Shark Tank investor Mark Cuban? Send an email. That's what Ryan Becklin, founder of Durham startup Validic, did, and within an hour, Cuban, also the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, sent his first response. Chatting after the release of a securities filing with new details of the deal, more than $700,000 in equity financing from 14 investors, Becklin tells Biz that he sat on Cuban's email address for months without taking action. Then one day, around noon, he had a whim and started to type. It was just a broad outline, he says. By 7 p.m., we had a deal. All this and he still has never met Cuban in person, he admits. And Becklin doesn't make a habit of sending cold emails. I just always felt like it was a shot in the dark kind of thing, he says. But it was how he organized that shot in the dark that caught Cuban's interest, he thinks. It was very direct, he says, adding that the directness was intentional. You're thinking about your audience. He's a busy guy. He gets tons of emails. I just tell him the high points. And evidently, Cuban liked what he saw. Being direct and keeping your emails brief is key when trying to contact someone such as Cuban, who likely gets hundreds of emails a day. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun and Lauren Onsorge. And now we turn to the reporter pages, and these are the pages that have the People to Watch articles. First, we start with Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And there's also an introduction before the articles start concerning the different people to watch. With many national economists describing 2014 as a breakout year for business, how well North Carolina captures its share of that growth will depend a lot on the success of a new plan that North Carolina Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker, the state's chief salesperson, rolls out this year. And with that growth also comes new jobs and new homes for people moving to the state and into the Triangle. Tim Smith of Preston Development Company and Keith Harand of Newland Communities have been put in charge of jump-starting two of the biggest real estate projects in Triangle history, Chatham Park in Pittsboro and Wendell Falls in eastern Wake County. The two projects combined could add enough homes for 70,000 more people coming to the Triangle over the next 30 years. And in the People to Watch, first, Tim Smith, co-owner, Preston Development Company. In his years developing upscale real estate communities like Preston in Cary and Wakefield in North Raleigh, Tim Smith says he never had protesters with picket signs. But Smith, co-owner of Cary's Preston Development Company, has never tried to tackle a project as big or as expensive as Chatham Park, a 7,120-acre site near Pittsboro that's expected to add 60,000 new residents in a town with a population of 3,800. Smith had hoped to get the town board's approval for the rezoning of the entire 7,100-acre site at a meeting in late November, but after 5 hours of discussion and people outside the courthouse carrying signs that read, "Don't vote tonight," and "What's the rush?", the board voted to table the request until a meeting in early 2014. Pittsboro Mayor Bill Terry was elected in November, partly based on a platform that included slowing down approvals for Chatham Park. Most of the land is undeveloped and currently zoned for rural, residential, and agriculture, but Smith says they are still making progress. "I think it will move forward and hope to get a vote in the next month or two," he says. "We're trying to answer all their questions just like we've been doing the last 8-9 months. Smith and his partners at Preston Development, including co-owner Julian Bubba Rawl and SAS co-founders Jim Goodnight and John Saul, have invested more than $120 million in the acquisition of land and planning for Chatham Park since buying their first piece in Chatham County in January 2006. The hurry now, Smith says, is that he has potential buyers ready to start building projects at Chatham Park who are also waiting on the rezoning. "I'm like a horse in the starting gate," he says. "And time is money." UNC Hospitals is one of 5 applicants vying to build a new 90-bed nursing home in Chatham County, and the hospital system has selected a site at Chatham Park. UNC has also applied for a certificate of need from the state to build a new 10-bed inpatient hospice facility at Chatham Park. "They're a little worried about the delay in the rezoning," Smith says of his contacts at UNC. "And if the town denies the rezoning request, they could apply for Chatham Park to become its own incorporated town, like St. James Plantation near Southport. We want to be part of the town of Pittsboro, and we will continue to pursue that until they tell us they don't want us," Smith says. "But if they vote us down, we won't have a choice with the investment we've already made." And People to Watch, Keith Harand, Senior Vice President, Mid-Atlantic Region, Newland Communities. When the developers of Wendell Falls were pitching their plans for the 1,400-acre community, Wendell town leaders were promised it would bring new tax revenue, new jobs, new roads, and help establish their small eastern Wake County town as an emerging market in the Triangle. But the only promise that the developers were able to keep was the construction of a $20 million highway overpass that until December 2013 pretty much led to nowhere. All other construction work at Wendell Falls was halted in 2010 when the property went into foreclosure and the owners filed for bankruptcy. Since that time, Keith Harand has been keeping an eye on Wendell Falls. From a business standpoint, it's an emerging market. From a developer standpoint, quite a bit of heavy lifting had already been done by the previous developer, says Harand, senior vice president in charge of the Mid-Atlantic region for California-based Newland Communities. Newland and its financial partner, the North American subsidiary of Japan's largest home builder, Seiksu House, in October paid $34 million to buy Wendell Falls from Wells Fargo, which is less than half of what the bank had invested in the property since 2007. Haran says he could start selling home lots and let builders start building homes as early as next spring. Phase 1, with about 350 home lots, is already about 90% ready for construction. But that's not his or Newland's style. Priority 1 will be finishing a thorough Charrette-style marketing study with plans to start construction of Wendell Falls' first amenity in summer 2014. We really feel it's important to create that sense of destination from day one, he says. I'm getting all kinds of calls from builders who are ready to go, but I'm not going to jeopardize the vision. Wendell Falls was slated to have up to 4,000 residential units at completion, plus about 2 million square feet of commercial development, but Haran says it's more likely Newland will develop the site with closer to 3,100 to 3,200 residential units. Otherwise, he says, they're sticking with the approved site plan for at least the first three phases of the project. Meanwhile, strong activity continues at Newland's Briar Chapel community in Chapel Hill that opened in 2008. Haran says they sold about 160 lots at Briar Chapel in 2013 and are projecting close to 200 lot sales in 2014. The Triangle housing market is projected to grow another 10% in 2013, says Jay Colvin, research director for Metro Studies Triangle Region. And finally, on this reporter page, we have the People to Watch article for Sharon Decker, North Carolina Secretary of Commerce. North Carolina Secretary of Commerce Sharon Decker has been optimistic about the headway her department has made toward job recruiting and job retention since she took office in January. But jobless numbers in North Carolina are still high, and she still plans to blow up the organizational model of the Department of Commerce by mid-2014 and transfer many of its powers and functions to a private nonprofit agency. We are not at net job growth yet, she says. We've had growth in manufacturing, financial services, and other areas, and those are encouraging indicators because they are from a diversity of industries. Still, there's a lot of work to be done. She'll be starting with a complete reorganization of the Commerce Department that will split many of its functions into a new private profit nonprofit agency, Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. It's necessary, she says, because North Carolina needs to respond faster to business requests and needs. We have to remember the competitive bar is always rising, she says. A lot of states are going after jobs very aggressively, and that includes recruiting businesses from North Carolina. By December 31, Decker says she will announce who she's hired as the new chief executive of the new private partnership. By the end of the first quarter, she expects to present her organizational plan for the new partnership to the state budget director, Art Pope, who must also approve it, and begin transferring the functions of business development and marketing, the two groups primarily responsible for job recruitment and job retention in the state, from the Commerce Department by the first half of the year. Decker says a second wave of transition to the partnership, including divisions of travel and tourism, film and sports development, and international trade and investment, will happen in the second half of 2014. There are still many questions as to how the partnership will interact with businesses on behalf of the state, but Decker reiterates that she's not doing anything that's outside what state legislation allows. We are not in a rush, she says. We want to do this well. Decker is also working to put the finishing touches on the state's new 10-year strategic economic development plan. The pipeline of active economic development projects going into 2014 is strong, she says, with about 200 companies, including North Carolina, on their short list of locations for expansion or relocation. Things are beginning to pick up, she says. We've been in a big, deep hole, but good things are turning in a way that's sustainable. And next, we have the reporter page for Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, higher education, and sports business. And his first person to watch is Peggy Kirk Bell, owner, Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club. The golf world will turn to North Carolina in a big way in June, as both the men's and women's U.S. Open championships will come to Pinehurst in back-to-back weeks. This will bring an enormous focus on some of the resorts in the area, including the famed Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club and the Mid Pines Inn and Golf Club, both owned by Peggy Kirk Bell, who is a charter member of the LPGA, Ladies Professional Golf Association. Opened in 1928 and 1921 respectively, the clubs feature golf courses designed by Donald Ross, the Scottish immigrant who designed nearly 400 courses and became one of the preeminent course architects in the history of the game. The club likes to say, "Probably no premier golf resort is closely associated with a family and an individual, as is Pine Needles and the Bell family, and matriarch Peggy Kirk Bell, who still brings her spirit and devotion to the game, perhaps nowhere more than in the resort's approach to instruction. She still makes teaching appearances at her golf schools, she named Golf Ferris." Bell and her late husband, Bullet, began running Pine Needles in 1953. They bought the golf course and land around it and began building the resort as it stands today. In the mid-1990s, the Bells acquired Mid Pines, and both properties remain with the family, with Bell's children and sons-in-law actively involved in day-to-day operations. When you look at the history and tradition of championship golf in Pinehurst and Southern Pines, certainly Mrs. Bell has had a huge influence on it, says Reg Jones, who has spent years working with the Bell family and was the championship director for the 2001 U.S. Women's Open played at Pinehurst. Certainly, she is a lady who is ahead of her time, but just as gracious as she could be. When you look at her influence, it truly is national and international, he says. The year 2014 will mark the first time in history that both tournaments will be played in the same year on the same course. When complete, the famed Pinehurst No. 2 will become the only site to have hosted all five USGA championships. Oh, and actually, there was also an intro on this page for reporter Jason DeBrun. Let me read that intro. With regard to people to watch in 2014, the president of the USGA would have been a good choice to highlight in this space with the return of the U.S. Open to Pinehurst. But the experiences people have at the resorts will likely have a greater impact on the state. That's why Peggy Kirk Bell and the staff employed at her resorts are people to watch. Similarly, I could have picked Brad Wilson from Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina or someone at the federal level involved with the Affordable Care Act rollout, but it's the strategy that health insurers take that will affect North Carolinians the most. Maureen Kelly O'Connor is the one to watch here. Patheon's CEO Jim Mullen was an easy choice. A month ago, his company merged and created a new company twice the size. As CEO of the new company, which could have major employment possibilities in the Triangle, Mullen is one to watch. And now we'll read the People to Watch article for Maureen Kelly O'Connor, Chief Strategy Officer, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Health insurance exchanges will take center stage in 2014, and what the state's largest health insurer does could go a long way in determining how they are received. In that vein, the decisions of Maureen O'Connor, the Chief Strategy Officer for Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, will be crucial for those who shop for individual health insurance. Although it sputtered out of the gate, the federal online health insurance marketplace, healthcare.gov, is beginning to work better. The federal government announced in mid-December that 9,000 North Carolinians had signed up for an exchange plan, and with the website now able to process thousands of users at the same time, government officials expect enrollment to tick upward. Plans purchased through the exchange, which are online marketplaces where people can comparison shop for health insurance, are directed at what is called the individual market, or to those people who buy health insurance directly from an insurer, not their employer. Already, Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina has announced it will extend various plans into 2014 that initially would not have qualified as plans approved under the Affordable Care Act. And as the person in charge of strategy, O'Connor will have to make more decisions like that in 2014. Maureen is one of the rare leaders in healthcare who has a vision for a better system, but also has the unique ability to know how to build a workable strategy and make sure the complex pieces fit together, writes BCBSNC CEO Brad Wilson in an email. Much of what we at Blue Cross are doing to improve healthcare across North Carolina is a result of her vision and leadership. As we enter a revolutionary new era in healthcare, Maureen is a valuable leader who is committed to making the system better. According to her profile, O'Connor is responsible for the healthcare and clinical division, network relationships and health system innovation, business development, analytics, health reform implementation, and public affairs. She joined BCBSNC in 2000 as Vice President and Deputy General Counsel, and later assumed the roles of General Counsel and Chief Administrative Officer. And in the final People to Watch article on this page, it's Jim Mullen, CEO of Patheon. Late in 2013, Durham's Patheon turned heads in the pharmaceutical world when it announced a merger valued at $2.6 billion that would take the company private and significantly increase its size. Naturally, what the company does in 2014 will be of major significance, and there will be many eyes on Jim Mullen, the CEO of Patheon, who will helm the new company. Patheon recorded sales of $1 billion in 2013 and projected sales double that in 2014. The merger was with Netherlands-based Royal DSM Pharmaceutical Products. The deal valued Patheon at nearly $2 billion. The new company, which was not yet named, will have 23 drug development and manufacturing sites in North America, Europe, Latin America, and Australia. It will have the capabilities to make everything from active pharmaceutical ingredients to finished dose products, and it will have 8,300 employees, according to Fierce Pharma Manufacturing, which tracks the industry. The North Carolina Biotechnology Center says the deal would be good for job retention in the Triangle and possibly even signal expansion here. Before being named Patheon CEO in early 2011, Mullen was CEO of Biogen IDEC. He helped that company merge with IDEC Pharmaceuticals to form one of the world's largest biotechnology companies. In his 30-year career, he has also worked at SmithKline Beckman Incorporated before it merged with Glaxo Incorporated. Patheon provides contract development and commercial manufacturing services to the global pharmaceutical industry. Now we turn to the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. And first, there's an introduction before we get to the People to Watch articles. The year 2014 could be one of disruption. Take Chinese computer maker Lenovo, for example. Known as a PC giant, the company, with its America's headquarters in Mooresville, wants its mobile reputation to match the PC buzz. In 2014, it could either make a dent in the Apple-Samsung dominance or get trampled, meaning North American head Jay Parker is certainly a man to watch. In Raleigh, Bandwidth's just-released Republic Wireless is aimed straight at the wireless titans, giants such as Verizon and AT&T. Industry watchers love the service, but will consumers? The year 2014 is a field test for CEO David Morken. And in Durham, IPO buzz is swirling around Judd Bowman and his company, Appia. And the first People to Watch article is David Morken, CEO of Bandwidth. For tech disruptor David Morken, a lot is riding on 2014, as in the focus of his entire company. Morken, CEO of Raleigh-based Bandwidth, launched Republic Wireless out of beta mode in November. The service, lauded nationally by tech critics such as Walt Mossberg, has wireless giants such as AT&T and Verizon in its crosshairs. And former general manager Brian Daly says that's exactly what it's supposed to do. The technology allows your phone to operate primarily off of a wireless router with plans in the single digits per month. Last year, Morkin told us that what was holding Republic Wireless back from greater consumer adoption was the equipment. But as of November, the service uses a Moto X on par with other top smartphones. After a highly buzzed about launch party and international media interest, it's time to prove it can disrupt. With a cheaper plan, a better phone, and a Sprint backup, Republic Wireless is out of excuses. Now all that's left is to see whether consumers will buy what Morkin's selling. But Republic Wireless isn't the only initiative Morkin is backing. Bandwidth's venture arm just made its first outside investment in Dally's real estate crowd lending platform, Ground Floor. Additionally, Morkin is involved in Christian-centered venture fund, Sovereigns Capital. And our next People to Watch article is on Jay Parker, North American head of Lenovo. For Jay Parker, North American head of Lenovo, 2014 is about building. The year 2013 was about building the brand, while 2014 may just be about building adoption and backing up that buzz. Lenovo is known internationally as an electronics giant, the number two smartphone maker in the world. But in the United States, its reputation has largely been in PCs. While the Chinese computer maker did overtake rival HP this year to claim the top PC title, executives have their brains in other places, Parker's included. Parker's 2013 talking point has been PC Plus. Lenovo, he says, isn't about PCs, it's about connections, and those include tablet and smartphone offerings. The first step was to release the new Yoga tablet, launched by actor Ashton Kutcher. The next step, a United States smartphone launch. But in order to compete with Samsung and Apple, Lenovo needs to become a household name, and that's what marketing promotions involving Kutcher are all about. Parker tells me Lenovo will start offering smartphones in the United States as early as 2014. And they could even be manufactured here. Lenovo's manufacturing line in Whitsett, he says, is fully capable of creating smartphones, complete with a Made in North Carolina sticker. As Parker heads the United States unit, all eyes will be on him to see if Lenovo can accomplish what it did with PCs in mobile devices. Whether Lenovo is physically ready to release U.S. smartphones in 2014 or not, it has a lot of brand building to do. Additionally, the company is trying to recreate itself as being based in both China and Morrisville. Increasingly in conversations, executives use the phrase dual headquarters to describe the operation. Parker was promoted to North American head this year and answers to Jerry Smith, the Morrisville-based America's head, we'll also have our eyes on. And the last People to Watch article on this page is on Judd Bowman, CEO of Appia. For Motra City veteran and Appia founder Judd Bowman, the spotlight is on, as rumors circulate that his company could be IPO-bound in 2014. In 2013, Bowman nabbed the coveted North Carolina Technology Association Tech Executive of the Year Award, a prize previously awarded to ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson. To keep up with the hype, Bowman has to constantly reevaluate, the only way to stay ahead. Earlier this month, Bowman announced that his mobile user acquisition network had launched Discovery Ads, a native ad format for mobile websites that allows them to integrate into their own content. That offering pits him against the likes of Google. Bowman has a cushion. A recently announced $4.5 million debt haul will fund the company through 2014. But that's not why we're watching him. We're watching him because, as he'll tell you, there are three paths a venture capital startup can make or can take: failure, a sale, or a public debut. Earlier this year, we asked him flat out if he was considering an IPO, a timely question in that he had just hired execs with IPO experience, such as former iContact CFO Tim Oakley. Right now, with this type of growth, we're just trying to stay as focused as we can, he says. You'll notice that isn't a no. And our next reporter page is for reporter Dawn Curry. Curry covers money and small business, and she also has an introduction before the People to Watch articles. Be sure to watch the company Morinaga America Incorporated in 2014 to see how an industry is changing the economic landscape of Orange County. This company will be one of the top corporate taxpayers in the county, creating jobs and strengthening the labor force. Also watch Raleigh's new city manager, Ruffin Hall. While the newly appointed Hall hasn't yet had much of a chance to prove himself since he began work mid-November, he'll be tackling several key issues in 2014. When the state legislature reconvenes, the North Carolina Film Office director, Aaron Surrett, my third pick, will continue the fight to keep the 25% North Carolina film incentive that is set to expire in 2014. And the first People to Watch article we'll start with is on Aaron Surrett, director of the North Carolina Film Office. When the state legislature reconvenes in 2014, the North Carolina film incentive will be back on the chopping block. The 25% tax credit is set to expire January 1, 2015. Since the incentive's implementation in 2006, the amount of money film production spend in the state has increased each year, along with the number of jobs added per film. The year before the incentive went into place, film production spent $1.5 million in the state and created 16 jobs according to state records. A year after the incentive, the numbers jumped to $117 million spent in the state by film productions, and 8,833 jobs were created. In 2012, the filming of Iron Man 3 and The Hunger Games created about 20,000 jobs. Whether or not the incentive will be renewed depends on legislators, some of whom don't agree that the industry brings a significant amount of money to North Carolina's economy. Despite the North Carolina Film Office reporting the 2013 in-state spending as a result of filming in the state totaled $245 million and created 25,000 job opportunities. Senator Bob Rucho argues that the state benefits very little from any kind of tax incentives and that direct jobs gained are too small to justify the loss of tax revenue. Those in the hospitality sector, particularly in Charlotte and Wilmington, worry about revenue loss after the sunset of the film incentive. Aaron Surrett, director of the North Carolina Film Office, said he believes thousands of jobs are at stake and hundreds of small businesses that support North Carolina's film industry will lose revenue. The industry will take an active role in advocating for the extension and/or the elimination of the sunset provision in the statute, Surrett says. Part of the film office's strategy to educate legislators on the economic impact filming has on North Carolina will be to present the findings of NC State University's Rob Hanfield study, which examines the film industry as a supply chain. Hanfield is NCSU's Bank of America University Distinguished Professor of Supply Chain Management. The study has yet to be completed. I didn't realize the incentive is essentially one of the most important factors when deciding where to shoot a film, said Hanfield in October when he first began his research. If legislators pull it, the whole industry would pull out. It would affect local businesses, restaurants, hotels, and construction. Something has been filmed in every single county in the state, so literally every county is impacted, he says. Virginia has a 15% tax credit with an additional 5% if filmed in an economically distressed part of the state. South Carolina's tax credit covers 20% of in-state wages, 20% of out-of-state wages, and 30% of supplies. Georgia offers a 20% tax credit with an additional 10% if the Georgia Peach logo is used. Louisiana has a permanent 30% tax credit for filming, and Tennessee also has a 25% film incentive like North Carolina. Ruffin Hall, Raleigh City Manager, is the focus of the next People to Watch article. Although he's only been in his new position for a little more than a month, new Raleigh City Manager Ruffin Hall will make sure Raleigh maintains the innovation it's known for by keeping an open mind. Hall was appointed to handle the city of Raleigh's key issues, including developing plans to support population growth, transportation integration and funding, infrastructure expansion, long-term planning for water supply, coming up with innovative ways to deliver services, balancing economic growth, building private and public partnerships, and balancing growth and sustainability. Hall could end up increasing community engagement based on his legacy as Charlotte's former assistant city manager. In Charlotte, I worked with transportation and small business where the priority was strong, so I helped several different initiatives to build involvement, says Hall. Although in Charlotte, Hall focused on economically distressed corridors and neighborhoods, he said he wouldn't necessarily need to do that in Raleigh. I want to grow jobs here, he says. My goals will be aligned with that of the council. Raleigh Planning Director Mitch Silver says Raleigh's population is at a tipping point where the city will grow urbanized beyond previous recognition. Silver says trying to stay ahead of and accommodate for the growth means recognizing what sort of people might come to live in Raleigh in 10 years. What are they looking for? Creative spaces, housing, and transportation, says Silver. The light rail is critical and will help to manage growth. It's not a matter of if, but a matter of when. While Hall says he supports anything that helps grow state businesses in an innovative way, such as parklets in front of businesses, his reach will also extend back to Charlotte. Charlotte City Manager Ron Carley said he looks forward to the opportunity Hall's appointment presents to strengthen the relationship between the two cities. Carley says Hall's analytical and problem-solving talents will serve him well in his new job. And the last People to Watch article is on Masao Hoshino, CEO of Morinaga America. When Morinaga America decided to build a 120,000-square-foot plant in Orange County to make Hi-Chew candy, it positioned itself to become one of the three top taxpayers in the county, behind Duke Energy and Piedmont Electric. The $48 million investment was announced in September, and the plant will be built in the Buckhorn Economic Development District near Mebane. It is expected to be completed by mid-2015 and create more than 100 jobs paying average annual salaries of $38,000 plus health benefits. The North Carolina Department of Commerce offered the company a $264,000 performance-based grant from the One North Carolina Fund, contingent upon a local match from the Orange County and Mebane governments. Orange County for many years was off the radar for companies, says Orange County economic developer Steve Brantley. Projects were bypassing the county and going to adjacent counties. The county rezoned about 2,000 acres near interstates and readied sites for utilities to make them more attractive to site selectors and aggressively marketed those sites. This ultimately allowed Orange County to beat out Durham, Greensboro, Toronto, Oregon, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Morinaga America's CEO, Masao Hoshino, returned to the site a total of 13 times before the September announcement was made. Brantley believes he was able to seal the deal because he had Japanese business experience, which the culturally aware Japanese don't take for granted. Morinaga America, while headquartered in Japan, has factories in California and New Jersey, but more importantly has roots in America. The founder learned how to make confectionery here in the United States and used that knowledge to start the business in Japan in 1899. It is therefore a great pleasure for us to build a factory in Orange County where we have complete faith in and work with the community, Hoshino says. To us, contributing to Orange County's industrial growth is synonymous with being recognized as a corporate citizen and loved by people in the county. Morinaga is recognized as one of the largest candy and confection manufacturers in Japan, with $1.75 billion in global sales and more than 40 product lines. Now we turn to the People on the Move page in the Triangle Business Journal, and we'll read the People Spotlight. And the spotlight is on Paul Sotile, Dean of Academic Affairs at the Chef's Academy, North Carolina campus. Having experience marrying food with the corporate world, Chef Paul Sotile is now in a position to help culinary students marry knowledge with careers. Sotile's background as a chef includes working as a chef at the UBS North American headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut, and as an executive sous chef at Lehman Brothers on Park Avenue, New York, And now, as the North Carolina Campus Dean at the Chef's Academy, the Culinary Division of Harrison College, Sotil can now focus on training the next generation of chefs. As the new campus dean, Sotil is responsible for furthering the development and success of the Chef's Academy's students. Additionally, he will be charged with managing all faculty members at the college, administering school policies and procedures, assisting in the development of the academic budget, and establishing and maintaining high-quality standards in the delivery of the Chef's Academy's educational services. Sotil first joined the Chef's Academy in 2011. He has served as a chef instructor at the school for the last 2 years, specializing in teaching stocks, sauces, soups, and fish and shellfish cookery, as well as instructing a variety of food service courses. Headquartered in Indianapolis, the Chef's Academy opened a second academy on a 4.37-acre campus in the Triangle in August 2011. The school students are taught in the fields of culinary arts, pastry arts, and hospitality and restaurant management through classroom and experiential instruction. Background: Sotil was born and raised in Port Ewan, New York. He has more than 25 years of experience in restaurant, hotel, and corporate food service. Prior to joining the Chef's Academy, Sotil served as a chef at UBS, executive sous chef at Lehman Brothers, executive chef and general manager at GE Global Research, and at GlaxoSmithKline. Sotil has been in his current post at the Chef's Academy for about 2 months. Education: Associate of Applied Science degree in Culinary Arts and a Bachelor of Science in Food Service Management from Johnson & Wales University. Master's degree in Organizational Leadership from Colorado State University Global Campus. Goal: Our program requires a big sacrifice on their part, and I want to focus on ways to increase our retention and graduation rates by continuing to build a program that can help meet the needs of our student base, Sotil says. What's going to change at the organization during the next year? We anticipate some alterations to our curriculum that should improve the student experience and keep us competitively positioned, Sotil says. What is your biggest worry? Most of what I worry about are things mostly outside of my control, health and well-being of loved ones, Sotil says. What's on your holiday wish list? Actually, not too much, Sotil says. I'm just looking forward to some good meals with family and friends and enjoying my kids. Personal: Sotil and his wife Jillian have 2 children, Ryan and Isabella. And on the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read the guest column. On the guest column, it's the views written by Jay Darby, who is a partner at Sullivan and Worcester in Boston, Massachusetts. The headline: Federal taxes are rising dramatically. Taxpayers are in for a huge shock. Taxes will increase dramatically for the 2013 tax year. This increase is not just for millionaires, but will also land on middle and upper middle class taxpayers. No one piece of the 2012 tax law is devastating, but collectively it imposes a hefty tax increase on a surprising number of taxpayers. Here's the big picture summary. The headline-grabbing change was increasing the maximum tax bracket on top-earning taxpayers from 35% to 39.6%. However, that is not where the real action is. The biggest changes are 2 phase-outs that impact single taxpayers with adjusted gross income of more than $250,000 and joint filers with an AGI more than $300,000. The phase-outs are: 1. The personal exemptions phase out, which eliminates all personal exemptions for single taxpayers with AGI between $250,000 to $375,000, and for joint filers between $300,000 to $425,000, and 2, the PEAS limitation, whereby itemized deductions are phased out at a rate of 3% of AGI more than $300,000. The personal exemptions phase-out is the big bite because it phases out personal exemptions rapidly over a relatively narrow range of income, and for a family of 4 produces the equivalent of an additional tax of almost 5%. Ouch. The 2012 Act increases the maximum tax rate on long-term capital gains and on qualified dividends from 15% in 2012 to 20% in 2013, applicable for single taxpayers with taxable income of more than $400,000 and joint filers more than $450,000. Also taking effect for 2013 is the net investment income tax, which imposes a 3.8% Medicare tax on a wide swath of passive income. The threshold for the NIIT is notably lower than other taxes, starting for single taxpayers at $200,000 of modified adjusted gross income and at $250,000 for joint filers. What can you do before December 31? Reduce LTCG and NIIT taxes, 23.8% combined, by harvesting capital losses. Make charitable contributions. The PEACE limitation will phase out these deductions relatively slowly, and additional charitable contributions will likely benefit you dollar for dollar. Make charitable contributions from your IRA instead of your bank account. This avoids increasing your AGI, which in turn increases your phase-outs. Convert IRAs to Roth IRAs and enjoy a permanent tax-free return at prevailing market rates. And we have another guest opinion. This guest opinion is from Lyles Carr, Senior Vice President of the McCormick Group, an executive search firm in Washington, D.C. He also serves on the board of ACT for Alexandria, Virginia. The headline on his guest opinion article, Message for Washington, D.C., Don't Stifle Desire to Give Back. Virtually all Americans give back in one way or another. It's a rich tradition that has long defined our society. But why? What's the motivation? Many in Washington, D.C. are seeking an answer to that question as lawmakers debate potentially harmful changes to the charitable tax deduction. Some think Americans who claim the deduction do it out of self-interest for the tax break and that it's a loophole for the wealthy. They are wrong. Perhaps they have spent too much time inside the Beltway. It may be counterintuitive to some, but those of us fortunate enough to be in a position, no matter our income level, to donate our money or our time to aid the most vulnerable and improve our communities, do so because of the inherent desire to help others. We give because we were instilled with the values of hard work, responsibility, and compassion for our neighbors. We are grateful to our families, friends, and communities for providing us opportunities to succeed. Scientific research suggests our brains are hardwired to be generous and to look out for the collective good. People give to charity because it's instinctively the right thing to do, it is deeply rewarding, and it benefits others. That's my motivation, pure and simple. In my lifetime, I have contributed to a diverse range of causes, from education and health to community development and houses of worship, from after-school activities for at-risk youth and women's empowerment to cultural endeavors. Nearly 100 years ago, our elected leaders were clearly onto something when they tapped our potential for giving and established the charitable deduction. That's why I'm particularly concerned that today, lawmakers are seriously considering upending this valued American tradition. Such a move would be disastrous for the millions of individuals who rely on the support of nonprofit programs and services funded in large part through individual donors. Any limits to the charitable deduction will hit hardest those who need the most help and put at risk billions in private donations that support diverse, worthy causes. According to one estimate, donations to the nonprofit sector could decline as much as $5.6 billion per year. That is more than the annual operating budgets of the American Red Cross, Goodwill Industries International Incorporated, Habitat for Humanity, the Boys and Girls Clubs of America, Catholic Charities USA, and the American Cancer Society combined. The charitable tax deduction made it possible for me to give more than I might otherwise have been able to do. The collective benefits that charitable contributions bring to communities and citizens are significant. This vital infrastructure employs nearly 14 million people, one-tenth of our workforce, provides food and shelter for the most vulnerable, strengthens communities, and fosters innovative solutions to some of our toughest problems. According to United Way Worldwide, nearly two-thirds, 62% of Americans, would curtail their giving significantly by 25% or more if the charitable deduction is capped or limited. The United Way also says that a 2.5% reduction in donations would mean 1.3 million fewer times the organization can provide job training services to an unemployed worker, home care for an elderly citizen, housing support for a single mother, or a mentor or tutor for an at-risk youngster. I strongly believe in the power of charitable giving to create jobs and economic growth, improve health care, feed the hungry, and shelter the homeless. Viewing the charitable deduction as just another tax loophole that needs to be closed ignores its true purpose. Millions of people will be put in harm's way if lawmakers tamper with it. They would be wise to keep that in mind as they consider the potential consequences our communities will face for the policy decisions they make. And with our remaining minute, we'll read as much as we can of the Executive Voice article featuring John Campbell, chairman of Raleigh-based trash metering company Waste Zero. The headline, "His goal is saving the planet one trash bag at a time," with a dateline of Raleigh. John Campbell, chairman of the board of the Raleigh-based trash metering company Waste Zero, worked in the healthcare pharmaceutical sector before he made the switch to trash. He founded Campbell Alliance, a management consulting firm which was sold to Inventiv Health and Thomas H. Lee Partners, a Boston-based private equity firm. Campbell also founded the Pharmaceutical Institute and previously was vice president of a U.S. subsidiary of GlaxoSmithKline. He co-founded Healthmatics, an electronic health records company, which was bought by Allscripts. He also worked with Lawrence Investing Company of New York. And we're going to stop there because we have run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.